Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Shomas against Colvin. Ms. Marcus.
May it please the court. Good morning, judges, counsel. My name is Meredith Marcus, and I represent the plaintiff appellant in this case, Randy Shomas. It's Shomas's position that at the minimum, the administrative law judge should have found the existence of a medically determinable physical impairment that exceeded the 12-month period and precluded substantial gainful activity. Appellee's brief supports Shomas's argument that the disability extended for a period that exceeded 12 months, and at least then Shomas should have been entitled to a period of closed disability benefits, especially when it gives its timeline on page 25 through 27 of its brief, while excluding some relevant doctor opinions, including Dr. Goodman's, who on two separate occasions prior to and after Shomas's surgery listing him as disabled. These temporary restrictions, as the appellee refers to them, precluded Shomas from performing full-time competitive employment for a period that did exceed 12 months. Further, the fact that Shomas did undergo this extensive conservative therapy, as the administrative law judge referred to it, and then went ahead and had this significant surgery of a lumbar fusion, should further support Shomas's subjective complaints of pain and weigh towards his credibility, not against it. With respect to the 2010 functional capacity evaluation that the judge referred to and weighed towards finding Shomas capable of light work, it's Shomas's position that this functional capacity evaluation didn't find Shomas capable of light work. It was qualified. It did indeed state that it was light work demand level as to lifting and endurance with further restrictions, and those restrictions were qualified as to occasional standing, occasional walking, occasional bending, and the like. Light work generally entails the ability to be on one's feet up to 6 hours a day walking and standing every day, and Social Security Rule 83-10 further explains that light work requires a good deal of walking and standing and states that there are very few unskilled light jobs that can be performed from the seated position. The appellee also states that the administrative law judge considered this occasional standing, walking, and bending when providing the hypothetical question to the vocational expert at step 5 for the sit-stand option. It's Shomas's position that this sit-stand option might very well have included a restriction from prolonged sitting or standing, but it really doesn't encompass occasional sitting and standing, and it wasn't properly accounted for by the administrative law judge in coming to the residual functional capacity evaluation. It's also worth noting that
are those schedules that refined where they talk about how long they have to stand, how long they have to sit?
I'm sorry, could you repeat
that
question?
Are they that refined?
In the functional capacity evaluation? I mean, it states occasional as to all of them, and it goes ahead and refers to, on page 3, I believe, of the functional capacity evaluation, it reflects the DOT, and which does state that occasional as to the sitting, standing would fall under sedentary employment. The administrative law judge's decision, it's also worth noting, does not have any of these doctors' restrictions from employment. It doesn't have Dr. Lorenz, Dr. Goodman, Dr. Ghanayem's restrictions from work or listing that he is disabled. While these might not have been medical source opinions, the administrative law judge was required to consider these opinions when coming to his residual functional capacity evaluation. They are all absent from the decision with the exception of the 2008 residual functional capacity from the state agency treater. It's also worth noting that Shomas at age 50, he turned age 50 on December 10th of 2008. It's Shomas's position that, if anything, he would have been capable of sedentary work at that time, and as such, pursuant to the medical vocational grid rules of 201.14, he would have been considered disabled and gridded out at that time. Turning to Shomas's credibility argument, it's not in contention by either side that the administrative law judge utilized boilerplate credibility language. The question then is, to what extent the administrative law judge then complied with Social Security Rule 96-7P and the respective regulation in coming to the credibility finding. It's SCOMAS's position that the majority of the credibility determination rested on objective factors and not subjective ones. In particular, SCOMAS takes issues with the walking 1 to 2 miles per day that was noted by the administrative law judge in his decision. It's not clear from that decision whether the judge noticed or took into consideration that this was doctor-prescribed walking therapy. This is similar to and akin to the case of Carradine versus Barnhard, where the court found that this was indeed walking prescribed therapy prescribed by a doctor to counter the pain that Carradine was experiencing. And likewise, like Carradine, SCOMAS was not contending, which is clear from his hearing testimony, that he was totally incapacitated or paralyzed. He stated in his hearing testimony that he could walk a couple of blocks before the pain became overwhelming. Like Carradine, this walking therapy was prescribed to counter the pain levels. This case is distinct from Zatz versus Estrue, which the appellee cites to, where the individual undertook to walk the more than 5 miles per day on his own accord, and there were no further restrictions limited or noted in the record. Moreover, in that same note that the judge relies on the walking 1 to 2 miles per day, Dr. Goodman also stated that SCOMAS was disabled, and he likewise noted that SCOMAS would need to lie down multiple times or sit down multiple times throughout the day due to his levels of pain.
But isn't the therapy prescribed, it does cause, even though you have the pain, you're still required to walk? I mean, that's part of the therapy.
Of course. But, it, I mean, in that treatment note, it's reflective of the fact that pain was still elicited through this walking, and it doesn't take into consideration how the walking therapy was performed, if he could walk only a couple steps or a couple of blocks before the pain became overbearing. And it still doesn't factor into how someone could go ahead and perform regular and routine walking on a up to six-hour a day, every day basis. If the panel doesn't have any further questions, I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Kenny Kleinman.
May it please the court, I'm Ann Kenny Kleinman, and I'm on behalf of the commissioner. I think the most important thing to do in this case is to look at the entire picture. Appellant is arguing for a closed period of disability and saying that if you add up all the opinions, there should be a 12-month period at least where he could not work. But as appellant admits, she's excluding some relevant doctor opinions, and those relevant doctor opinions indicated that the claimant could, in fact, work during that alleged 12-month closed period. Appellant argues that the ALJ should have relied on opinions by Dr. Lawrence, Dr. Goodman, and Dr. Ghanayem. Even if the ALJ had considered and discussed Dr. Lawrence's opinions, it wouldn't have helped. Dr. Lawrence initially stated that the appellant should be off work while he was getting treatment, but then Dr. Lawrence said, you need to get a functional capacity assessment, and whatever that functional capacity assessment shows, those will be your permanent restrictions. So he went, he got the functional capacity assessment, and that assessment showed he could do light to medium work. Thereafter, Dr. Lawrence didn't treat the claimant anymore. So had the ALJ relied on Dr. Lawrence's opinions, the ALJ would have in fact found he could do light to medium work. The same type of thing is happening with Dr. Ghanayem. Dr. Ghanayem initially said, you should stay off work while I'm treating you. Dr. Ghanayem did the surgery in July. In November, he said, you should get a functional capacity evaluation. That evaluation was done in January, and it showed that the appellant could perform a limited range of light work. that included only occasional standing, walking, and sitting. So again, the ALJ did in fact rely on Dr. Ghanayem, and the ALJ's decision is consistent with that opinion and with the functional capacity evaluation. When the VE was asked to consider that the claimant could only stand, sit, and walk occasionally, which is defined as up to a third of the time. The VE was asked to assume that the claimant had an at-will sit-stand option. Now, an at-will sit-stand option means the claimant can sit as much as he wants, or stand as much as he wants, or walk as much as he wants, or as much as he doesn't want to. So if he wanted to avoid all kinds of standing and walking, he could under an at-will sit-stand option. And under an at-will sit-stand option, the VE identified thousands of jobs that the appellant could perform. So
I know this doesn't play into it, but identifying thousands of jobs doesn't mean those jobs are open for you just walk in and get the job, right?
Well, under our regulations, we don't consider whether somebody can walk in and get a job or whether they would be hired. It's whether they can actually perform that job.
So it doesn't matter that the person who's filing the claim doesn't want to work there, and the people who have those jobs may not want them to work there either.
You're right, Your Honor.
It seems to happen, and this is the nature of the beast here. But when you get down to the sedentary work and jobs available, it's, yes, they're not disabled, but at the same time, the job is going to be pretty hard for everybody. They're not going to hire them, and they're not going to want the job. It's sort of that combination when it gets there. That's not your problem. I understand that. Is there some issue about waiver here? About arguing before the district court versus what's before us now?
It's interesting you bring that up. The arguments that were raised in the district court are significantly different than those that are raised on appeal. We would suggest that they may have been waived because they are so vastly different. However, even if this court considers the fact that they argued in general some arguments about physician opinions and some arguments about credibility, the ALJ's decision and the ALJ's discussion of physician opinions and credibility is very well supported, and the appellate court can affirm on that basis without dealing with the issue of waiver. Even though we suggest that it was, in fact, waived. As far as credibility, the ALJ conducted a very thorough analysis. He went through the factors that the regulations suggest an adjudicator should consider. The ALJ did, in fact, discuss the type, nature, location, frequency of the pain. He talked about back pain, hip pain, right leg pain that radiated to the right hip, what aggravated it, walking, standing, lifting. He talked about the type of treatment in various types of forms, whether it was, say, hospitalizations or surgery, or whether it was just office visits. He talked about type of medication used, whether it was narcotic, really the strong kind of narcotic pain medication, or just, you know, mild medication. He talked about the fact that claimant did use some self alleviating measures such as sitting, lying down, and walking while he was recovering from that surgical procedure. The ALJ discussed the objective medical findings, the examination findings. The ALJ discussed the claimant's activities, including the walking that was, in fact, prescribed by his doctor, which the claimant did as part of his recovery from surgery. The ALJ, in short, went through the entire analysis that he was supposed to go through. He laid out a clear path of his reasoning, and he related the evidence to his conclusions. That is what's required under the regulations, and that's what the ALJ did.
But the ALJ did give some weight to the fact that he had not been hospitalized that often or sought emergency room treatment for his pain, didn't he?
Yes, the ALJ did. He noted that that's a kind of treatment that you consider.
What if no doctor recommended that? I mean,
that by itself might not indicate that a claimant's complaints are not credible. But when you consider that fact, along with the milder medications, along with everything else, the daily activities and the rest of the treatment, it all, when you look at the big picture, it all suggests that, yes, he had pain, but it wasn't of a severe disabling nature. It was of a less limiting nature. And, in fact, that's what his doctors kept saying. Every time a doctor said, not every time, but often when a doctor said you have to stay off while you're having treatment, the doctor then reversed course and said, okay, you can go back to work. Some doctors, like Dr. Heim said, medium work. Dr. Lawrence said, based on whatever the functional capacity said. Dr. Ghanayem said, whatever the functional capacity said. All these doctors are saying, you can work. You might not be able to do all the jobs, but you are able to do at least a limited range of work, and that's consistent with the ALJ's decision. If you have no further questions.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. Anything further, Ms. Marcus?
Yes, going first to the closed period of disability benefits, counsel discussed the fact that the 2008 FCE found SCOMAS capable of returning back to light capacity work. But then if you look at the lineage of records and treatment, immediately following this functional capacity evaluation, Mr. SCOMAS then went on directly to a pain management specialist, Dr. Goodman, within actually 2 weeks, it looks like, of the functional capacity evaluation results, where Dr. Goodman told him to remain off work. If you look at, while I agree that perhaps there's not the level of hospitalizations in this record, if you look at the fact that SCOMAS went to initially a chiropractor, then to physical therapy, then went to injection therapy, and then eventually surgery, it shows a whole lineage of going from treater to treater to treat this significant amount of pain that was substantial to Mr. SCOMAS. With respect to the sit-stand option, counsel said that one can have the ability to sit and stand with flexibility throughout the day. However, the rules and regulations have stated that there's very few unskilled light jobs that have that flexibility of sitting and standing, and in fact, most of those jobs are managerial-type jobs. The jobs in this case were cashier, assembler, and hand packager, which don't allow that flexibility of sitting and standing throughout the day. SCOMAS likewise contends that he's capable of doing that sitting and standing option throughout the day. As to the credibility that the administrative law judge took into consideration in this case, it's reflective heavily on the objective evidence in the record and doesn't necessarily encompass all of those notes from the treaters, Dr. Goodman, Dr. Lorenz, et cetera, with respect to Mr. SCOMAS's pain levels that were elicited on each of these visits. In particular, looking to the fact that SCOMAS was only on the lack of heavy narcotics. Even the district court judge noted that in 2008, SCOMAS was on Darvocet and Ultram prior to then the surgery and then being prescribed this more heavy narcotic medication. Finally, all these opinions, restrictions from work, it's worth noting again, are not considered by, or at least not in the administrative law judge's opinion, raising the inference that they either weren't considered or ignored when coming to this residual functional capacity evaluation, and in SCOMAS's position that those opinions should have been properly considered when coming to the light-skilled work. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.